Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hello and welcome to the LSE for this hybrid event. My name is Shakuntala Banerjee and I'm Professor of Media, Culture and Social Change in the Department of Media and Communications here at LSE. I'm also Programme Director for the MSc in Media Communication and Development. I'm really pleased to be able to welcome Daniel DeSimone, Dr. Clive Nwanka, and Anne-Marie Cousins to both our online audience and our audience here in the Old Theatre today. Daniel DeSimone is a correspondent for BBC News, where he researches stories involving crime, injustice, and violent extremism. Recent investigations include the murder of Stephen Lawrence and an abusive MI5 agent. He was educated at LSE. In fact, we've just talked about your masters. Clive Nwanka is Associate Professor in Film, Culture and Society at UCL Institute for Advanced Studies and a Faculty Associate of the UCL Sarah Redmond Parker Center for the Study of Race and Racialization. He is also a Visiting Senior Fellow at LSE's International Inequalities Institute, which sponsors today's lecture. Anne-Marie Cousins is a counsellor for Abbey Wood and lead member of Community Safety and Enforcement at the Royal Borough of Greenwich. In this role, her focus is on encouraging greater community engagement and enforcement for the safety of all communities. At today's event, we will be discussing the major BBC investigation by Daniel DeSimone, which produced new evidence revealing the identity of a previously unnamed key suspect in the April 1993 racist murder of black teenager Stephen Lawrence by a gang of white men in southeast London. For Twitter users, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSEIII. This event is being recorded and we will hopefully make it available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. As usual, there'll be a chance for you to put your questions to our speakers. For our online audience, you can submit your questions via the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen. Please let us know your name and affiliation. We are particularly keen to hear from our students and alumni, so please let us know. For those of you here in the theatre, I will let you know when we'll open up the floor for questions. If you could raise your hand, and then I will indicate you can pose your question. In the same way, the online audience provide their name and affiliation. I will ask you to provide the same information before posing your question. I will try to ensure that we take a range of questions from both online audience and our audience here in the theatre today. Now, I am delighted to hand over to Daniel DeSimone. Thank you very much. Please welcome.
Well, thank you very much. As was said, I was a student here at the LSE, and it was a few years ago now, but I used to come to events like this, and what all of those events had in common was the speakers were far more distinguished than me, so it's very flattering to be here now talking to you all. If I could just work the slides.
The clicker.
As you see behind me, it's just a few miles from where we are now in Eltham, southeast London, and it was around 10:40 p.m. on the 22nd of April 1993 that this young man, 18-year-old Stephen Lawrence, was stabbed to death in a racist attack by a gang of young white men. And Stephen was a beloved son, brother, he was an aspiring architect, and his life was taken from him. So his life was taken from him, and what he might have gone on to achieve, what he would have gone to achieve, was taken from everyone and from British society. And it was very much a local crime carried out by local thugs. And what should have been a murder that was easy to solve, really, it should have been solved, wasn't. And turned into probably the most notorious of all cases for the Met Police. I'd say probably the most notorious racist murder in the UK. And in the battle for justice over the following decades, you know, a great deal about the UK has been laid bare, with the case having a real profound social impact and changing the law and policing. So I'm going to describe a bit about the history of the case. I'm going to then talk a bit about how I became involved and what my research is, and then a little bit about what I think the case says about the UK now. So if I can just ask people to look at the slide. This is the scene of the attack. On the night in question, Stephen and his friend Dwayne Brooks were heading home. They were just going home. They lived in different places, and they were changing buses. And if you can see, they were... Sorry, I'm moving away. But you can see, Steve, there's a bus stop there, which is where Stephen and Dwayne were waiting. It was around 10:40, and they moved up towards the roundabout that you can see at the top of the screen, because the buses were a bit late that night, and they were trying to see if they could see them coming. And you can see where it says the attackers approached from. Stephen and Dwayne were just calling to each other about the buses when a group emerged from where it says the attackers approached from. A racist slur, what, was shouted, and then a racist slur. I'm not going to say the racist slur, but it's widely in the public domain. And then they rushed towards Stephen and Dwayne. They were attacked. Stephen was attacked, stabbed to death. And the attackers made off up Dixon Road. Quite quickly, within 24 hours, police received a lot of information, start from within 24 hours and over the following days, that implicated some local well-known youths in what had happened. In particular, there were five prime suspects became very well-known and quite infamous. And I'm going to click through and you're going to see a little bit about them. And this is probably quite a notorious scene of them leaving the public inquiry into the murder in 1998. Oh, sorry. Well, it doesn't work, but never mind. But that's some of them leaving the public inquiry in 1998. They were not arrested for as quickly as they should have been. But they were arrested after a couple of weeks. A case was built against some of them, and then it was dropped. Then it was dropped by the CPS. And then the family, the Lawrence family, had to try and take over a private prosecution themselves. And really, the following years, really, and the following decades, are very much driven by Stephen's family. You can see Doreen, now Baroness Lawrence, and Neville Lawrence. And the history of the case is that the family felt immediately that the case wasn't being handled properly. They just knew it in their bones. They sensed it from the way they were being treated. They knew that the police, they felt, weren't following up on the information. And they felt that the police just didn't want to know, that they didn't really want to do everything they could. And so they had to become a public face of the campaign for justice. And as I say, in the mid-90s, they decided to do an unprecedented thing, which is to bring a private prosecution themselves, which led to three of those suspects being put on trial at the Old Bailey just down the road. That case collapsed, meaning the three of them were acquitted. At that point, that meant they could never be put on trial again for the murder. And the case was really a huge deal in this country for many years. It was in the news daily, certainly weekly. And the way it played out was followed by the whole country. And it led to the new government in 97 ordering a public inquiry into the murder and how it had been handled. And that public inquiry, known as the McPherson Inquiry, took evidence over several months, reported in 1999, and concluded that the Metropolitan Police was institutionally racist. And its short summary was, you know, that the investigation of the killing had been marred by a combination of professional incompetence, institutional racism, and a failure of leadership. And it also considered whether corruption had played any role in the murder. And what the public inquiry really did is laid bare the failure of that police investigation in a detail which the police would never have imagined would have come to public attention. They never imagined that this would become this big case, that their senior officers would be forced to come into the public and defend what happened. I've spoken to colleagues who covered it at the time who feel that, you know, it was one of the first times, really, that in the UK that people up and down the country were sort of forced to see what this family had endured. And all they wanted was justice. They were normal, loving, law-abiding family who then had to take on this kind of state intransigence and institutional racism and failure, and just to try and get justice for their son. And so that really laid it bare. And following that, the Met had to set up a new inquiry, a new police investigation, which went on for several years. my research, I would feel that was also very flawed. It didn't lead to any convictions. Eventually, a detective, a bit of a maverick detective, took over the case, Clive Driscoll. He did get two convictions in 2012, two of the prime suspects. And then the Met spent quite a lot of time investigating further, having sacked Clive Driscoll from the role, didn't get anywhere. And then they closed the case in 2020, saying that kind of all viable lines of inquiry had been followed. But I think what, and it was at that point, then I'm a journalist, so I work for BBC News, and I do sort of investigations, and I'd never had any connection to the case, but I'd always read about it. It meant a lot to me growing up, reading about it, I'd read books about it, but I'd had no involvement in it. So I thought, well, is there something I could do to research the case and look into it? So I started looking into it. I spoke to Clive Driscoll, and one of the things that I sort of came to understand quite quickly is there was quite a lot within the case that hadn't been fully looked into, even after the McPherson inquiry. So there was a view, and the Met would still say this, that that McPherson was a watershed, and then after that, it's been fine, and that all the inquiries, investigations have been thorough, and there's no issue with them. But that isn't really the evidence. I think there were still problems after that. And one of the things that became quite obvious quite quickly is that Dwayne Brooks, on the night when he'd been with Stephen, had said to the police that there were six attackers, and that he had described quite clearly on the night, not to one to a police officer, he noted down to other police officers, and in a statement, that a lead attacker in the front had been the one who shouted the racist slur, kind of run ahead of the others, struck Stephen first, you know, and then that person was described physically, and it was accepted within the McPherson inquiry and by a force that did an independent review of the case in the 90s, that person in the front, described by Dwayne and others who were there, wasn't one of the five. So this just seemed, no one seemed to really be aware of this thing. It was kind of quite, to me, it seemed like a big kind of hole in the case. So I sort of started looking at that. And what I'm just going to show you is this is one of the EFITs that was produced by witnesses. If you see this, what became known as the fair-haired attacker. And someone who was described as about 21, 22, so older than the prime suspects were in their teens, about 5'10", medium build, medium fair length hair. Dwayne had described it as bushy light brown, very clearly bushy light brown. And then the police had not properly dealt with that. And it was a simple fact, the police had not properly investigated that information. And they hadn't eliminated suspects with it, they had failed to properly investigate it. So when I started looking into it, I was told there was a witness called Witness K, who'd be given the alias Witness K in the 90s, who may have been this person. I was looking at whether this person, Witness K, was at the scene. And Witness K was someone called Matthew White, who had been in the case from the start. He died in 2021, just around the time I really started looking into this. And I had to then investigate whether this person was the fair-haired attacker, or was a suspect, or really investigate his place in the case. So was he a suspect? Was he a witness? Was he nothing to do with it? And that's sort of what I did. And the more I looked into it, I was quite shocked, really, because if you stop someone in the street, and people in the street in the UK, and ask them, what's the most investigated murder in the UK, I bet you quite a lot of them would say Stephen Lawrence. Because some people, and I've had it, many people write into me when we do stories on Stephen saying, oh, not this again. There's people feel this has always been looked at, there's always been inquiries, that surely there can't be anything else to look at. And I just found that really wasn't the case. There was actually quite a lot that wasn't done at various stages and when it was closed in 2020. So the person who's Matthew White, Witness K, was in the case from the start because he was known quite quickly to have visited the home of the Acourt brothers, who are two of the prime suspects, on the night of the murder. But he was never treated as a suspect. which is extraordinary, really. If you think now that there's a murder down somewhere in London, and there's prime suspects, and then there's someone who's known to have been with those prime suspects shortly after the murder, you'd probably think that person would also be looked at as a potential suspect, but he wasn't. And the more I looked into it, I realised that a lot of the strands of evidence and information that had come into the police, which had been quite telling in terms of how much they knew about what happened, from different witnesses, including a police informant that wasn't dealt with properly, another witness, had really could be traced back to Matthew White, witness K. And the evidence was placing him at the scene. The police had had quite a lot to do with him. He'd never been very helpful to the police. He'd kind of told the police to get lost, really. And the police knew very well what he looked like. They knew about his previous behaviour, and some of that behaviour was consistent with someone who would do this kind of thing. And there were a lot of strands pointing to him. And what I also found is that the police force had reviewed it in the 90s, reviewed the case, and had said to the Met at the time, "What have you done about this guy? You know, what is he? Is he possibly at the scene? Because he seems to know so much so quickly. What are you going to do to check it? You know, was he there?" The Met had then just done nothing with that in 97. After McPherson, they looked at him, but then just got another witness statement from him. So they didn't, you know, investigate him as a suspect. And then what happened in 2000 is that a witness they spoke to, they weren't expecting this, but that witness gave a long account which said that White had admitted being present and involved in what had happened. And the account of that witness rather mirrored what Dwayne Brooks had described on the night, which was, you know, running ahead of the others, shouting, other things. The police response in 2000, I found, was to go and show that witness statement and read it out to Matthew White, who then just said, well, didn't say anything, didn't deny it, didn't know, went, well, said it wasn't me, and then just went no comment, and then showed it to other people, which is, created a problem for the witness. And ultimately, the point was the Met didn't really thoroughly investigate that person, Matthew White, as a suspect at that stage. They didn't do everything you would expect them to do at that stage. And unsurprisingly, they didn't get a charging decision, in him being charged at that stage. And there are very big issues with how they handled that investigation in 2000. When you go on, so Clive Driscoll, when he did the successful investigation after he got the convictions, what I was told is that he had then started looking at the whole case. So he'd sort of gone back to the beginning, started looking at all the messages from the beginning, all of the statements, and tried to see, well, what happened to that bit of information? Where did it go? Where did it lead? And after a few months, they had a message in the system from 1993, which said that a named detective had said, "I know Matthew White's stepfather, and he's saying that Matthew White's not telling you everything he knows." And that had not been properly followed up. And the lead detective at the time had noted all this, and it hadn't been properly followed up. When Clive properly then followed it up, 20 years afterwards, he found the right stepfather, the police had gone to the wrong one, who basically said, "Well, I tried to speak to you. I wanted to speak to you, but you didn't come and talk to me. And, you know, what I wanted to tell you is that my stepson told me he was there when the murder happened. He was there, and he knows who else was there." So you had two witnesses at that point, you know, who had said he'd admitted it. And at that point, Clive Driscoll was made to retire, replaced as the senior investigating officer. And the police subsequently put a file into the CPS on Matthew White on the same day that Clive Driscoll left the police force. He didn't think that inquiry had been totally completed, and that there were things he would have done before he was looking for a charging decision. And again, there was no positive charging decision. So what I then did in 2020, when I started looking at it, I was just trying to investigate this person, because, you know, if you've read books about this case, if you've watched programs about this case, the person called Witness K was all over it and was sort of mentioned multiple times in the public inquiry and was seen as an important person in the kind of chain of information on the night, because he'd spoken to another witness and he was known to have gone to the aid courts. So he was like a figure in the case, but as a witness, had been mentioned in the trial that had resulted in the convictions in 2012 as a witness. So there was a public interest in correcting the record, at the very least, that this person had been a suspect. But what I wanted to do is also just to try and investigate as much as I could about whether that was fair, whether he really was a suspect, or was that an unfair designation. So what I sort of set about trying to it sounds silly, but kind of do a police investigation, which is kind of speak to as many people, gather as much police evidence as I could, which isn't easy, speak to as many witnesses as I could, and that's sort of what I did. I spent like a couple of years doing that, 1 year sort of quite intensive, and in the end was satisfied he definitely was a suspect. There was a lot of evidence that did implicate him. It's not to say there isn't undermining evidence, and that has to be taken into account. But what I also found is that the police had not fully checked his alibi. He had lied in his statements. I was told by police officers when I was doing the research that there was witnesses in particular who, because they'd said that White had told them, that they told White about the incident, that it showed that White wasn't there, and then that was the key thing that meant that the police were satisfied that he wasn't there. When I went and spoke to one of those people, the other one being dead, that witness told me that they'd never told the truth to the police, that they'd lied, and that they'd never given an honest account. White had actually told them about the incident, had told the sister about the incident, having run from the direction of the incident. So the thing that was being used to give an alibi, one of the main things, was false. And the police had not checked that at any stage in the preceding 20 years. I also found that White had attacked black men in Eltham, mentioning Stephen Lawrence. He did so. One of them, he told him he would get Stephen Lawrenced. Another one, he tried to stab with a dirty syringe, said he'd killed before, then was made a reference to a Stephen. Neither of these victims were ever spoken to by the murder investigation. There was a lot of issues with the Met's handling of Matthew White. And one of the key things as well, if you go back to what I said about Dwayne Brooks' description of what the lead attacker looked like, the so-called fairhead attacker, Matthew White looks exactly like that. So these were surveillance pictures taken just after the murder, on a property that was being looked at by the Met in relation to the murder. And White, there are other images, because the slide thing's not fully working, that he basically looked really like what Dwayne described. The Met knew that, but they didn't do anything. If you see there, there is a comparison to a couple of the EFIDs. And the Met had just not dealt with that at the time or subsequently. So, you've got a witness who's given a good description of a suspect that has never been properly looked at the time. You had a person who fitted that description, who was up at the home of the prime suspect on the night, was known to have carried knives, was lying to the police, and those lies could have been checked. And Dwayne Brooks was effectively gaslit, really, for many years, that he was a bad witness and everything else. And actually, he'd given a very clear account. It's the Met police had failed to progress it properly and deal with it. What I wanted to say a little bit about is why I think this matters. I think that in this case, despite it being so well known to so many people in this country, it's got such name recognition, almost certainly for many years you wouldn't find anyone in the country who hadn't heard of it. I think that's over the years fewer people have heard of it, but it's still a very well known case. But what I've found, despite that, despite multiple investigations by the police, police watchdog, official reviews, inquest, public inquiry, and the public inquiry effectively being a landmark public inquiry that kind of everyone's heard of, that what, unless some, if something is hidden, I've found it kind of remains unexamined. That it's only when things are brought out into public, and that journalist's job is to do that, that, that the institutions are forced to fully be honest about it and look at it. And I think that, to me, is like a motivating factor for still looking at this case. There's still so much that's sort of not fully known about some of the things that went on. Were there corrupt links between the suspects and the police? There was certainly a corrupt link between the father of one of the suspects and some police. There's still things that aren't known, and it's only by bringing out the film we did about this suspect, White, and what happened, that this has become something that was known. You know, the actual public record was significant that said this person was a witness, and it's now been corrected that this person was a suspect. It's been shown how the Met didn't handle it properly. That's not fair on anyone. It's not fair on anyone that that's not been handled properly, because it means there's some things now that won't be fully recoverable and fully knowable. The evidence on that suspect points towards the outstanding suspects who are still around. There's three of them who are still walking around. I've gone and chased them down the road. They're still about. It doesn't point away from them. So there's that opens a route up to getting the other suspects. And one of the things I think I did find, and it was that when I went around talking to so many different people, I think I found something that was a bit depressing, really, which is that I kept being told that negative things about Stephen Lawrence, which weren't based on any fact. It was based on sort of rumour and hearsay that, you know, somehow he's a baddie, you know, and that he shouldn't have been there and things like that. I kept being told that. And, you know, the people he'd come into contact with are the baddies. You know, he came into contact with a violent world, violent crime, drugs, bad stuff, really nasty stuff. And that's what he just tragically, he came into contact with that by that bus stop, through no fault of his own at all. So I kept feeling there was this sort of ingrained racist view of Stephen Lawrence, and I kept getting it. And I think it impacts, I do think it impacts the willingness of people to help some people, not everyone, but some people, because he is being still really kind of dehumanized. And I found that depressing. And I think that does say something still about society, that still happens now, despite this case being so well known. And what the other thing I've found is that the Met at the public inquiry, one of the defences that quite a few of the officers were asked, do you accept this was a racist murder? You know, bear in mind there's a racist slur shouted, and then he's stabbed to death. Most people would see that as racist, but lots of the police officers didn't see it and argued it wasn't a racist murder. One of the pieces of logic that was used by some of the officers was that, well, the suspects had attacked other people, white people, as well in the past. So how can it be racist? Because they've attacked other people who aren't black. And that was something. It's not something like, you know, it's not very logical. But, and I get that as well. So there's a kind of almost a trickle down from things that were said there by police officers to the doorstep to witnesses who could help actually, but kind of some of them choosing not to. And, you know, the finding of institutional racism in 1999 by the McPherson Report is probably the best known thing, I'd say, probably, about that inquiry. And it's probably worth just reading it out, because, you know, the term is used, but often the definition isn't used. Institutional racism consists of the collective failure of an organisation to provide an appropriate and professional service to people because of their colour, culture, or ethnic origin. It can be seen or detected in processes, attitudes, and behaviours which amount to discrimination through unwitting prejudice, ignorance, thoughtlessness, and racist stereotyping, which disadvantages minority ethnic people. And the fine of issues of racism was in 1999, that fine, that report that's there. And, you know, there was official review of the Met by Baroness Louise Casey that was published just over a year ago. And that report, that report concluded the Met remained institutionally racist, is still an institutionally racist force. So it's sort of been echoed, really, across the, you know, 24 years, 25 years now. And I think that is, well, it's something the Met is obviously being asked about and is being asked to deal with. But certainly for me, like, you know, the Met, I've had to go to the Met with what I've been doing, with my sort of research. You know, it's part of journalism. You go and give a right reply and you give the organisation a chance to respond. And the Met has apologised for failings in 1993. The Met has, post McPherson, accepted that the 1993-94 investigation was a disaster, that it was deeply flawed, that inquiry, that investigation has kind of polluted, really, all later attempts to bring people to justice. But my experience is that the Met then remains, sort of, if you like, hangs the failures over any failures over the later decades on that period. But I would say that some of the later investigations are also deeply problematic. The investigation that began in 1999, just before McPherson, basically anticipating that they were going to be criticised, was also deeply flawed. I think that the investigation that concluded in 2020, there were significant gaps. If you look at, you know, there's still things that weren't done. If you think about the alibi, for example, on Matthew White. So, you know, I think there are big questions really remaining for the Met on this case. You know, what's happening recently is that last month, following a story we did with an interview with Stephen's mother, the Met announced a few hours after we ran the story that it was going to be commissioning an independent police force, to review the case to see whether there are any things that weren't done, whether there's still opportunities, whether there's lines of inquiry that can be identified that could still lead to other outstanding suspects being charged, being brought to justice. And I think that's why, you know, it's important to keep talking about the case, to keep looking into the case, because it's not over. You know, it's still not resolved. There are still people who haven't been brought to justice. And, you know, the case in the 90s, 2000s, and still, like, it's, you know, it's been like a kind of a great animating force, really, for justice, for racial justice, for social justice. And that there's so much that is actually good that's come, you know, from Stephen's name, from Stephen Lawrence's name. So I think for all of those reasons, it's still really important to keep talking about the case. It's why it's so, I'm grateful to Clive for asking me to come and talk about it. And that, you know, if people keep talking about it and keep looking into it, it means that there may yet be a chance for full justice for Stephen Lawrence. So thank you very much, and look forward to hearing from the others. Thank you.
Thank you.
Firstly, I just want to thank Daniel for his amazing and quite inspiring talk about his work on this case. But of course, also want to thank Shakuntala, Anne-Marie, and my colleagues at the LSC for accepting my proposal to have this event and listen to Daniel talk about his amazing work. I want to open my quite brief response to Daniel's talk with this iconic image of Stephen. As a child in the 90s, like so many, I remember so clearly the moment when I first encountered this image on a Friday evening in April 1993. When returning home from school, we were met with the image of a black male youth on BBC London News. This was an image that would, in the days, weeks, and months after the incident, become so positioned within the consciousness of myself, my family, and those around us within the dense black community of Neasden, Harlesden and Stonebridge, an area that was once described as UK's blackest borough. As a result, Stephen's image would become an image that shaped my nascent and developing understanding of black identity, anti-black racism, of South East London, of Britain, of the dangers faced by black young men and children. However, the image had a powerful positive dimension and influence, and just like Stephen had ambitioned, instilled in me an immediate desire to one day study architecture. This, of course, didn't take place. However, 31 years later, the Stephen Lawrence case and Stephen Lawrence's image is so central to everything I do as an academic, both in terms of my research on black identity, anti-black and racial injustice within culture and within cultural production, and also how we can identify the political and cultural legacy of the 1999 McPherson Report, in which anti-racism was replaced with the easy idea of diversity and inclusion. The image of Stephen Lawrence carries with it so much beyond the image of a talented 18-year-old young black man who was so violently taken away from his family on that evening in Eltham on the 22nd of April 1993. It's an image of both the past and the present, of the internal and also the public. The image of Stephen Lawrence is a collective symbol for the many other young men murdered in racial attacks in and around South London throughout this period. Roland Adams, Orville Blair, Rohit Duggal, and the later decade, Manish Patel, Ricky Reel, Sheldon Bob. It's an image that recollects the public inquiry of 1999 and how London's black community descended upon Elephant and Castle in a collective support for racial justice. It's an image for the protracted public campaign for justice that brought two of Stephen's killers to justice in 2012 and carries with it the collective work of the Lawrence family, Imran Khan QC, DCI Clive Driscoll, and so many others in this endeavour. It's an image that speaks to the aspirations, hopes, and experiences of an integrated multiracial society. This is an image that also invokes the labour, resilience, and suffering of an identity that has and remains so invisible and unconsidered within our social, political, and cultural life, that of black women. It holds the struggles of Baroness Doreen Lawrence and many other black women who stood at the forefront of our black communities under violent siege. The black feminist activist and writer, Stella D'Aziz, declared that black women have and been and will continue to be strong, resilient and courageous despite the fact that we are the most oppressed group in the society we live. As Audrey Adams and Dori Lawrence, two of many trailblazers for racial equality, search for answers in relation to the racist murder of their sons and so many others, they were subjected to a continued disrespect, contempt, attack, surveillance, suspicion, disregard in their pursuit of justice, fairness and accountability, an experience that, just as Malcolm X diagnosed in his critique of America in 1962, reminds us that the most disrespected woman in Britain is the black woman, the most unprotected person in Britain is the black woman, the most neglected person in Britain is the black woman. There is much derision and contempt that is met when black people talk publicly about the idea, meaning and manifestation, of black intergenerational trauma. So much doubt is placed upon our testimonies of how structural racism and trauma experienced by previous black generations carry an intergenerational transmission that produces new collective trauma, illness and depression that are transmitted through the family, but also the racist structures, systems, institutions, discourses, narratives, and images, and underpin contemporary society's continued oppression of black communities. Thus, the image of Stephen Lawrence speaks to the continuation of that intergenerational black trauma in the failings of the Metropolitan Police, the sustaining of institutional racism, the denial of truth, accountability, and justice for black people within every sphere of public life and experience. We should not forget that Stephen lay bleeding to death on Wellhall Road, and the days and weeks after. The Metropolitan Police saw him not as a victim of a fatal crime, but as a potential criminal suspect. This is indicative of how they place a different value system on the life of Stephen Lawrence, and in how the Metropolitan Police failed to conduct a fair, rigorous and objective investigation to bring Stephen's killers to justice, because they placed a different value system on the death of Stephen Lawrence. This is the very same value system that is placed upon black people in our experiences of injustice and disparity in the criminal justice system, in the NHS, in the education systems, in political life, and of course, in academia across our campuses. Is it any wonder that this is the conditions of our existence for so many black people in the UK, just as experienced by Doreen Neville Lawrence and so many others, when this is the example that is given to us by our highest public institutions? The feeling I felt in the early evening of the 23rd of April 1993, when I first encountered the image of Stephen Lawrence, was akin to the feeling I felt at 6 a.m. on June the 26th, 2023, when I turned to the BBC News website and saw the headline of Stephen Lawrence. But this was accompanied by a new image, the image of the additional suspect in Stephen's murder. I was aware that there remained this unanswered question of an additional unnamed suspect that evening, and this was a question that I had myself explored in examining the numerous books, accounts, and reports on the incident in the context of my own research. The impactful work by Daniel speaks to the need for the preservation of public service broadcasting. As you've witnessed in the print media reportage in The Guardian, The Independent, and the continuing injustice of the scandal of Windrush, we see how societal and political value in broadcast investigative journalism gets to the very marrow of injustices, malpractices, and corruptions that mar our public institutions, and are so often subjected to political suppression for holding public institutions to account, as Daniel has done so amazingly. Thus, Daniel's work and the subsequent BBC One documentary that evening, Stephen Lawrence, the Sixth Suspect, reflects an investigative current affairs programme that is dismantled by media policy. As a young person, I was inspired by programmes such as ITV's World in Action and its campaigning journalism and LAMAC investigative work that uncovered the deep-seated injustices at the heart of our highest institutions and produced impact and redress. Now, the BBC's Panorama and Channel 4's Dispatches are arguably the last resemblances of a vital practice that is glacially being dismantled, subsumed, and replaced by our mainstream broadcasters in the benign concept of factual entertainment and programming, and the government's targeting of Channel 4 and the BBC that will ultimately impact its presence, commissioning, investment, and crucially, public attention. The Jamaican cultural theorist Stuart Hall once stated that television is both the medium where we seek identity and also the medium where it shapes our identity and reflects back to us our identity. In other words, who we think we are, who we believe others to be, how we think society functions, is all shaped decisively by television and media, and has profound social, psychological, cultural, and political consequences. Academic research, print journalism, social media, all can have and continue to have important contributions to the exposure of racial injustice. But this cannot and should not completely replace the presence and necessity of journalism through the lens of television, as we saw in the unprecedented public response to Daniel's work. And it possesses a particular power and social and cultural reach and impact when communicated to the nation through national broadcasters. The image of Stephen Lawrence carries with it so much that shaped this nation, but it also carries with it an important 31-year question mark. What happened on the 22nd of April 1993, and who was involved? And the continuing investigative work by Daniel should concern anyone who is invested in racial inequality in Britain, and also the investigation into the events of that evening. For as long as there are suspects who have not yet been brought to justice, and as long as there are unanswered questions about the actions and the failings of the police, there will always be something uncovered that is yet to be uncovered about a murder of Stephen Lawrence. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. It's my pleasure to be here. Good evening to you inside the room and to those listening online. As you've heard earlier, my name is Anne-Marie, and in our borough, Greenwich, we've just finished, we held it on the 26th of April, the 31st memorial of the murder of Stephen Lawrence. So in our borough, we're doing our bit not to forget. We cannot control all the narrative, but we're hoping that our young people moving forwards understand what went on and learn from it. They did artwork, poetry, things like that, and it culminated in a display in one of our iconic buildings, the Woolwich Works in Woolwich. So what is this all about? Some of you might be asking. 31 years ago, there are three names, and Clive mentioned some of them, that you must not forget. Not only was it Stephen Lawrence, in 1991, the 21st of February, Roland Adams was murdered literally 5 minutes walk from where I live. My daughter is here in the front row. She was born in 96, so it was before her. We walked through that alleyway, and not far from there, he was murdered. In 1992, there was another young man, Rohit Dougal. I'm probably not saying Rohit Dougal, probably not saying his name correct. Remember that, Dougal, D-U-G-G-A-L. That family really kept quiet. It was too much for them. And then in 1993, there was Stephen Lawrence. The Lawrences and the Adams fought, and it was the Adams case that the judge coined the phrase racist murder. And so, as Daniel said, it wasn't seen by the institutions as racist. The police did not accept that. It was the judge. And I'm quite happy to take the judge's decision on that. Racist murders. So that was what was going on. But where was I at that time? Where was I? I was living in Dartford. And for unknown reasons, well, not unknown, my mother thought I had moved to the Outer Hebrides. She lived in East End, Stratford. And it was like, it took forever to get through the Blackwall Tunnel to go and visit. I was working in the city at the time, and so I thought, you know what, let me move back home. Back home being in Stratford, East London. Couldn't afford it, and the nearest I could get was Abbeywood. Never heard of this place at all. So I moved there in August 1989. And one of the things that I do when I move into an area is I go to the libraries, I join the community groups, I find out what's going on. Yeah? Volunteering, things like that. That's how you really know what's going on in an area. It's just something I've always done. In Dartford, I was the novelty in town. In Abbey Wood, there was one or two more that looked like me, but you know, not so much, so many. The place was still known as a village, so it was Abbey Wood Village. And one of the fun names that I got to learn, we had this big roundabout with a hole in the middle. It wasn't called the Polo, it was called the Flying Donut. So I still refer to that particular roundabout as the Flying Donut. That was some of the education I got back then. Wasn't aware of anything going on. I parked outside my front door, jumped into the car, went to work in where I was working at the time, got workplace parking. So it's not like today, you can't park anywhere. Wasn't aware. And then one day, before then, I had joined BACA, Bexley African Caribbean Association. This was a group of people now my age. I was the baby of the bunch back then, yeah? And they were more a social group, you know, monthly, going for dinners, things like that. And so that was what I was doing. And it was Bexley, because where I live, although it's Greenwich, next door, literally I walk across the road, I'm in Bexley. There's one road, I can stand in the middle, and one foot will be in Bexley, and the other will be in Greenwich. I'm literally on the border. And so I was with BACA, and I eventually became their membership secretary. I also found out about another organization in 1990, which was Simba Family Association. They were based in Woolwich, and I was involved with some of their work and eventually became one of their trustees as well. Anyway, as I said, when these deaths started, well, these murders, it wasn't death, they didn't die of natural causes, it was like, what's going on? What's going on? I got onto BACA and I'm saying to BACA, we've got to do something, we've got to do something. They were saying, no, we're just a social organization. We don't get involved in these sort of things. I said, it's not on. It is not on. So I then became the face for BACA for going to participating in events, going to places, trying to find out what is going on, what we can do, what we can't do, fundraising. So many things were going on. So many things were going on. We went, marched on Bexley Council. Bexley Council took the brunt of it because we also then found out that at the time of these murders, it seems that local people knew and were saying who they felt were the perpetrators. And one of the things that came out was that we had a BNP office based in Bexley, in Welling, not too far from even where I lived, a good 20-minute walk, half an hour walk, and that it was felt that since that particular establishment moved into the area, that that was when all these stabbings and so on occurred. What we've got to remember also is that, yes, there were some deaths, but there were lots and lots of injuries as well. So lots of things was going on, but it was the murders that really put things into the spotlight. And so one of the things that we did, we were marching on Bexley. Bexley took the brunt of it in the early stages. Marching, going to their council meeting and demanding the closure of the Welling, allegedly a bookshop that no one could get into. Bookshop without books. Okay? So this was it. That's what it was licensed as, but that was not what it was operating as. So we were doing things like that, marching into these places. Also around that time, I think it was about 93, things were happening on Stratford side as well, through the other side of Blackwall Tunnel. Things were happening. And some of you may or may not remember, a few of you look a little bit of my sort of age in the audience, that Tower Hamlets in 1993, about September 1993, had their first BMP councillor. Do you remember that? Any of you remember that? They had their first BNP. That's how things were, that they actually managed to recruit a BNP, British National Party, as one of their councillors. Okay? So those were what we were living with at the time, and we were saying enough is enough. And another organization that formed as well was the Anti-Racist Alliance. And I became involved in that as well and became their first Southeast area. So that would be for Greenwich, Bexley, Lewisham, membership secretary. And one of the things they did as well was to organise information meetings, protests. You're nodding, I don't know if you know some of that, but yeah, just lots of things. We were out there on the street. I have, I'm actually quite glad to see, what do I press, the red one? This one. I'm trying to move, see if I can move that slide on. This slide was found by a young lady doing her PhD at the moment in Thamesmead. And she contacted people, and I thought I would engage because she was looking at what was happening around the Roland Adams time in Thamesmead. And when I was telling her my story and about the marches and things that we did, she was very surprised, and she did some research. And she found this particular picture, and she sent it to me, and she says, Anne-Marie, is that you in that picture? Now, back in those days, when we did things, it's not like today, the young people, you can't go anywhere without your camera and snapping yourselves. And I'm getting a little bit bad like that with selfies. When I found out what selfies were a couple of years ago, you know, you snap everything. If it moves, you're snapping it. In those days, we didn't. I don't even know if our phones could take pictures in the 90s, that one, definitely not. A phone was for a phone call, okay? And so I didn't know that there were any pictures. Well, apparently, let me take the glasses off, apparently somebody in there looks like me, and I wasn't sure. I had to give it to my children. I said, does anybody look like you? Of course, Mum, I can see it's you. I'm thinking, you're sure? Because I didn't want to take the credit or the, to say it was me if it wasn't, because I'd never seen it before. And she had done her research and came across a retired British photographer. Let me give you his name. And he had taken that picture, and he's given it to me, David Hoffman. He's a retired, he's online, so you can actually go online, so put his name, and if you put in something like Roland Adams, Stephen Lawrence, racism, you'll see what pictures he took. There's not a lot, because a lot weren't taken at that time, but it's online, so you can get those. And so I was, I have that picture now, I'm going to cherish it. You guys have it now to put in your archives as well. So that's what we were doing, we were marching. And I recall as well, one of the marches that I did, I had a black wreath, and we put it outside the offices of the BNP, the British National Party, put it outside their offices. Now, there are other marches where things went AWOL. I think the Stephen Lawrence one in about September or something like that, 1993, I do believe there were clashes and so on, but I don't think I was at that particular one. The clashes, the word on the street, a lot of people felt it was aggravated more so by the police. Sounds similar to today. We've heard earlier about the institution and institutional racism. You know, it takes one bad apple, they say. The word on the street at the time was that, certainly with Stephen Lawrence, people who knew who it was said, and I give thanks to those people, they did what they could. It was said immediately. They said, it's whatever happened inside the police. I can't blame today's police. I can't blame all of the police back then. But clearly, there was something. And on the street, the word was that it was corruption. It was felt that even if the police had every single information that we've just heard Daniel refer to, nothing was going to be done because of corruption. That's the feeling that was on the street. And that when Driscoll came in, the next question was, well, what on earth did he do for him to be sacked or encouraged to be retired? And so it doesn't leave a good sense of feeling for a lot of people. But that was what was going on at the time. I share these things with my children. It's my pleasure to be able to share it with you and to other children, because it's the only way we can sort of try and say, let's try not to do these things. But it was just senseless violence because they could and they did. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Lee, you can. We can move on the slide to the next one in a minute. Yes. Thank you so much for your presentations. And before I open the floor to questions, I just want to make a personal remark, which was that I was on the Roland Adams march as well as all the other marches.
Excellent.
And there were clashes, and there were fascists attacking those marches, actual proper Nazis with all kinds of Nazi regalia on. And I think there are a lot of people in this room and perhaps online who don't know what the BNP is or was. It was a brother organization to the National Front. It was the British fascists at the time. And it had an electoral strategy and was trying to get elected into every borough up and down the country. And it was very strong. And I taught in a school 5 minutes away from the murder and 20 minutes away from the headquarters of the British National Party, and it absolutely affected everything we did. Those were the kinds of discourses that we heard from some of the parents. The racial slurs were everywhere. They were written on the walls. They were graffitied on the books. My very first English class when I was 22 years old, I got a book back which had on the front of it, "I don't want to be taught by a P-word." P-word is packy. And we had to contend with that on a daily basis. So yes, there is a context to murder, to racist murders. But thank you again to all of you. I'm
going to first draw on the audience sitting in front of us and then go to the audience online to take questions. It would be great if when you ask your questions, you say who you are and keep it brief, but also if you're online, give your affiliation. So please raise your hand and I will select some of you. We'll go for about 25 minutes before we draw to a close. Who would like to ask the first question?
Good evening. Thank you all for your presentations. Thank you, Daniel. It's a bit of a sceptical question, forgive me. I appreciate all the work that you did, but because of the nature of the Stephen Lawrence murder and the sort of institutional racism and the kind of despondency in the black community, when I saw the sixth suspect sort of advertised on the BBC, my first thought was, oh, it's been suppressed until he died. And I wondered if anybody had come up with that rhetoric. I'm not saying that that's what happened, but that was just my first thought. And I wondered if you faced any sort of comments of that nature.
No, I didn't. I mean, some people asked what point I started looking at it, although the police had closed, the Met had closed the murder investigation in August 2020, and I'd sort of thought, well, let me try and do something after that. He died a year after that, and that was just around the time I was starting to look at it. So there wasn't any, you know, it wasn't that, obviously, I don't want anyone to die, I don't want any witnesses or suspects to die in the case, because it makes the case harder to look into, and, you know, it means it can't be resolved. So no, I didn't have, I've had people ask that, but no, that hasn't been a big theme.
Good evening, my name's John Robson, I'm a retired lawyer. My question's to Daniel. Obviously throughout the investigation and investigations going back on the case, there's been the issue raised about collusion with organised crime to possibly DS and maybe more senior levels. From your investigations, are you concerned that this was a factor?
I think it, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a resolved issue. I mean, there was definitely the father of David Norris, and David Norris is convicted, one of those convicted of the murder, so he is a convicted of murdering Stephen Lawrence. His father is someone called Clifford Norris, who in 1993 was definitely a very feared gangster in that part of London, and was in a corrupt relationship with at least one police officer, for sure. And that police officer later actually escorted Dwayne Brooks to the Old Bailey, from the Old Bailey. So, there was no finding that police officer had any involvement in the case other than that. But that shows, if you like, how close this all was. There's been allegations of corruption in the Stephen Lawrence murder inquiry in the early 90s. Those allegations have never been officially corroborated or led to, you know, a finding of corruption. I think there are still questions about some officers. There's, you know, one officer, I'm not going to name him, but it's widely in the public domain, was said by the Met itself to be a corrupt officer, and he was a very important officer in the case. But the corruption that the Met has said, or, you know, internal Met reports have said, didn't relate to Stephen's case. It related to later cases and other things. But there are questions about his performance in the murder investigation. Actually, also very much in relation to this suspect. This officer was the guy dealing with him in 93. I think there are big questions about his performance. That doesn't mean it is corrupt, but I think he didn't do a good job. There are other officers. We did a report last November about another officer who had a role, officially a fleeting role in the case, a guy called Ray Adams, who is a very senior officer and was actually in charge of all criminal intelligence for the Met for a period in the 1980s. And we did a report that showed that internally, and that report had concluded that he was actually corrupt, and that their own inquiries into him were lackluster, and that you know, that there was a conclusion that it appeared had been witness had lied for him and other things, and that witness had been linked to the Norris family. So there's I think one of the things that was said to me by lawyers for Michael Mansfield, actually, who was, you know, representing the Lawrence family in the public inquiry, is that corruption's hard to prove. You know, it's difficult to prove. It was hard to prove in 98, which is 5 years after the murder. It's even harder to prove now, when we're 31 years on. You know, there isn't like a paper trail of people saying I'm corrupt. And in the public inquiry, that Michael Mansfield and others were asking that there, you know, there be inferences drawn, or that it's possible that there was corruption. And that some of the corruption that was known about in the police but wasn't known about publicly would have helped those inferences be drawn, you know, that there was actually corrupt links between people connected to the case and people connected to suspects. So I think it's still not totally resolved. I think there's a lot of people that still think there was kind of corruption and collusion. I will still continue to look into that, and maybe one day we'll have more answers.
Thank you, Danny. Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
So we just have one question from Karen Bolton, who asks, what needs to change in local and national journalism to ensure that investigative journalism, like the work of Daniel Windrush, etc., can continue?
Okay, I think that's a question that all three of you could maybe answer. So, Daniel.
Sure,
first.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, happen to work for the BBC. I was definitely given the space to do this. I wasn't, you know, it was me that did it, to be honest. I wasn't like loads of other people doing it. Obviously, once you make a film, then other people come involved in making the film. I was just given the space to get on with it, really, and not sort of told, you know, this, you need to deliver this now. And, you know, I spent a long time looking into it. It doesn't mean I wasn't doing other things. I think, so it's about having newsrooms that value this kind of value investigative journalism, give it the space that it needs to happen. That, you know, that you can spend a long time looking into something and then it's not what it might appear, and that is fine and that is normal. And, you know, you might look into something for a long time and it doesn't actually stand up. So it just requires newsrooms to invest in it, really. And the BBC definitely still does. I think other broadcasters still do. Some of the newspapers do. I think that's dying a bit. I think some of the newspapers don't now when they used to. And I think a lot of it comes down to the change in kind of funding for the media. The media's, you know, traditional media's definitely got less money than it used to have. And so it's just about valuing it, really. And you know, it's about ensuring that people have the space and given the space to have the skills and just get on with it. That's my view.
Please, Clive.
I think to echo both the points of Dana, but also what I mentioned in my brief response, is the erosion of public service broadcasting as an idea and what that is meant to do in terms of service to the nation. I mentioned about the 90s, being a child and watching World in Action, which is a really kind of radical form of journalism that was really exposing corruption and malpractice in public institutions, be it the criminal justice system or other kind of monoliths. And there is a dying of that methodology, certainly. It's also risk. And that is a word I think is becoming less and less prevalent within the media. Who's prepared to take a risk in exposing very, very powerful institutions that have done wrong? Of course, Daniel's work is looking at the Metropolitan Police, which of course involves risk as well. But it's very, very kind of narrow. Finding those voices that are prepared to actually take quite risky moves in exposing forms of malpractice. So I think both the economic question is important, but I think it's also having the space to think around public service broadcasting is essential to risk and requires a certain amount of dabbling at the marrow of public institutions that may produce, you know, quite harmful outcomes as well. So,
thank you, Anne-Marie.
Maybe just briefly to say, as the mic automatically goes on, just briefly to say that the independence is important. I think if you're stuck in, there's an institutional thing, and to be honest, you were graced, the grace that you was given to do what you did is not the norm.
Yes.
So that's to be appreciated, and thank you to your organization for that. But I would say that a lot more reporters, investigative journalists, need to be independent, to be bold. I know you have to eat as well, but you might have to, you know, do some fundraising or something. But you have to be prepared to be bold, to go out there and, on to, you know, lift up those rocks that other people aren't prepared to lift up. There, you know, something, one of the things that I found with the internet, there is so much news online, but the detail isn't there. The detail is not there. So it's, for example, every month or so, you'll hear that one or two police have been dismissed because they've been found to be corrupt or disloyal or misogynistic or racist, or those are released. But yet you don't see anyone really taking them and putting them on the national media stage. But it's the police. So really what I'm trying to say is that the police is doing a lot of things to clean up its image, but it's really been done quite quietly. So a lot of people aren't aware. You have to go and look for those things on the internet, and a lot of people just don't do that. It would be great if a lot could just be brought out into the open, because I do feel, and we were sort of talking about this in the back before, that there are just so many things that I think I've lost my train of thought actually on that one, but we were talking about in the back about, let me leave it, I've completely lost my train of thought. It happens.
Thank you.
I've had a senior moment, sorry.
Yeah. Don't worry. That's great. Can I go back to the room if there's anybody else that would like to ask a question over here, please?
Hi. I just want to thank the panel for very interesting...
Introduce yourself.
Oh, sorry, yes. Ben Odofin. I'm a lifelong anti-racist activist and also a student, a graduate of politics. I just wanted to just briefly thank the panel for a very illuminating talk from three quite different perspectives. I've got a quick, hopefully quick, Janus-faced question, so I'm going to be looking back but also trying to look to the forwards. So in terms of the looking back, I'm wondering whether there is some acknowledgement actually that the Metropolitan Police itself, despite the findings of the landmark McPherson report in 1999, has consistently since then denied, or at least its commissioners, including the current commissioner, who apparently is reforming the service, consistently denied that their police force is institutionally racist. And I think that's part of the problem. As Malcolm X used to argue, you know, if you don't acknowledge that there's a problem, then you're part of the problem yourself. And the forward-looking part of my question is about, we're living now in a very nasty, anti-woke, Trumpian, you know, post-Brexit, anti-equalities backlash against what we thought in the 70s and the 80s and 90s were was a great deal of progress towards race equality and good race relations. So to what extent do people feel that even the very concept of institutionalized racism, which permeates so many of our institutions today, will even survive into the next 10 years?
Thank you. Great. We'll all take the question then, please.
Well, thank you for your question. I think, yes, the Met, you know, certainly the current commission as well, denies the Met is institutionally racist. Has refused to accept that term. The Casey review from last year also said the Met is institutionally misogynist, homophobic. I was very involved in the case of covering the case of the four young men who were killed by Stephen Port in East London. Mm-hmm. and all of the families in that case consider the response, disastrous response, to be homophobic, institutionally homophobic. The Met has denied that as well. So the Met doesn't accept that is right, that it has those issues. It's not for me as like a BBC journalist to say it is or not, but I mean, obviously my job is to expose failings and wrongdoing and other things. And I think that the Met has continued to, you know, not be completely... I think what I draw the comparison is that in the Daniel Morgan panel review from three years ago now, they said the force was sort of, there was a form of institutional corruption in the sense of the force just kind of couldn't look honestly at that case because there were so many issues within that case, corruption and other matters in the past, and it made it hard for it just to look at it honestly and go at it honestly. And I think there's something of that about Stephen's case, that there's a lot of, you know, issues with various matters in the past, not just in 93. And I think that does sort of, they're very worried about the case, the Met. For them, they see it as something that's caused them a lot of trouble, you know, over the years. And I think that's what could be very positive about this new review that's going to happen, that whoever ends up doing it, because they're coming, they're not the Met, you know, they're independent of the Met. I forgot the second part of your question. My apologies.
Looking forwards,
yeah. Well, I mean, I know what you mean. I think Stephen Lawrence, as I said when I was talking, was like a great animating issue, you know, for so many campaigns and for so many years. And it's still, through the Stephen Lawrence Day Foundation and others, a great, you know, force for good. And so much is still being done for good in his name. But kind of as a campaigning issue, it's not as prominent now. But when I've reported on it, I definitely have faced some of what you're saying, that I get a lot of emails and other messages saying, kind of racist emails, other things, saying, why don't you just leave this, you know, it doesn't matter, or kind of denigrating. And I find that depressing, really, because I think, you know, let's be honest, Stephen was just an 18-year-old boy, like, heading home, and his family faced appalling treatment, you know, and they just want justice for their son, that's what it comes down to. And if they'd had justice, then that, you know, that's what they want. That's why this is still a big deal, and this is why this family still want justice, why I'm still looking at it. You know, that's what it all comes down to. So I hope, hopefully, some of those attitudes, I think there's always going to be some of those attitudes, but I would hope that they'd lessen, that people, by talking about the case and the things, that people understand why this matters. Because it matters, because it's about injustice for someone who's been murdered. That's what it's, what it comes down to.
Thank you. Anne-Marie, I'll go to you next, and then Clive.
Lovely, thank you. Yes, I think that what we've got to remember, Roek Dougal, Roland Adams, Stephen Lawrence, those names, you know, let's not forget those names. They didn't just drop dead, yeah? They were murdered purely for the colour of their skin. And I think whoever is the naysayers and the anti-woke, or, you know, whatever terminologies that we use, I think that's fine. If it doesn't affect them, it doesn't affect them, but it affects me. I was living there. I know the fear that was in people, etc. We keep talking about it because it shows what's under the rocks if you don't turn them over. And we have to keep turning them over, because otherwise people think that it's okay to do that sort of thing. Or somebody will tell you their narrative, yeah, which doesn't reflect what was really happening. What we heard from Daniel, it was being said that, oh, Stephen Lawrence was into drugs, or, you know, he was the naughty one, or whatever. They weren't. These were people on their way home. Roland Adams, in actual fact, when you hear his story, it's quite shocking. He had seen home a young lady. They'd come from a youth center, Hawksmoor. Yeah? He had seen home somebody and was now going home with his brother. So he had done a good deed and ended up dead. So this is why we keep talking about it. We cannot believe those horrors. And I think where I ended my brief presentation with that slide showing the marching and the activism, it's a bit like what's happening now, isn't it? We have to do that. Because if we don't, the institutions that are not there, I don't see personally for myself, I see that I am an instrument for the institution to use to maintain the institution. So if I want something, I'm going to have to push against those boundaries. Now, the minute I stop pushing, it will go back. So I expect the next person to have to push. If you want similar or better, that's the only way we get movement, isn't it? And I think this is why we keep talking about it, because otherwise we'll go into a malaise, everything is okay, there isn't a problem, and start singing Kumbaya, my Lord, or something. It just doesn't work that way. We have to, if we want something, we have to have courage. And I really do think that you know, what you've done is courageous, because it goes back to the question about why have you done that, and why, it was the online question, wasn't it? About the, you know, why? What would we do to make more journalists do what you've done? And I said they need to be bold, courageous, all these things, and that's really what you've done. Unfortunately, we don't have enough doing that, because often it doesn't pay. You are lucky you are covered, but it doesn't pay. So I might be jesting about, you know, going fundraising or whatever, but it, you know, doing the right thing often doesn't pay. You have to volunteer your time, you have to beg, borrow, and hopefully not steal to progress. Yeah? And so yeah, I appreciate, you know, the work that you've done.
So that was kind of hinting also that there is a form of censorship that does hit people. Clive, perhaps you could answer both parts of the question.
Sure, I'll try and be concise as well. I think it's a really interesting question. However, I think in regard to institutional racism and its past, its legacy, and its future, I think my concern is less with definition and more about manifestation. So go back to 1999, it established institutional racism as something prevalent within the police, but also within broader society in the UK. So that was the diagnosis, but the policy wasn't anti-racism. What the policy was diversity and inclusion. Now, that has some good positive outcomes, but also some quite negative ones as well, because what that can do sometimes is kind of suppress or bury racism as an experience that we face, but also anti-racism as a policy. So I'm not convinced in my research and in my experience myself as a black person that we have a reliable or monolithic policy of anti-racism within the UK that will protect us from some of the kind of horrors that you've been describing. We have inclusion, but we have inclusion from a racial perspective in the Conservative Party. And what has been happening then? So the point I'm making is it's very, very easy to see how the erosion of institutional racism as something actually accepted by the police can take place when there was no real policy or impetus around anti-racism after the McPherson report that was reliable for people of colour. What we had was inclusion and diversity, which allowed for the multiplicity of difference within public spaces and kind of the public sector and culture, but that didn't address the main issue. Was Steen was killed because he was a black person. And diversity inclusion doesn't address those things. It didn't address George Floyd 4 years ago, and doesn't address anti-racism now. So I think the tension is the tension between the terms to describe racism, but also what the policy outcome is as well.
Thank you very much. We have time for one last question, and I think you already had your hand up over there.
Thank you very much. My name is Carmen Playfair. I'm a retired NHS physician and a lawyer. And my question is, I know all about NHS racism against black women, especially in maternity, black and Asian women. What I would like to ask is the question of compensation. The Met officer, the head of the Metropolitan Police, has a few weeks ago apologized again to Baroness Doreen Lawrence for the fact that the sixth suspect died and never was brought to justice. But the police started a campaign against the Lawrences and their solicitor of surveillance, of tapping their phones, etc. Were they ever financially compensated? Does anybody know? And the second question is, it's more like a remark. Corruption is difficult to prove, says Michael Mansfield, especially for investigative journalists. But that is simply because we still treat whistleblowers everywhere, in the NHS, in government service, as traitors, inside traitors, rather than as the moral heroes that they are.
Thank you for your question. Daniel.
On the financial compensation, I don't want to say I absolutely know, because
I don't, so I can't be sure. I know that there's been obviously complaints against the Met at different stages, by people who are affected. But I don't know. There's obviously, but also the Met have kind of consistently been forced to apologise. So I just don't know. I don't want to give you the wrong answer. On your second point. Sorry, can you just repeat the second point? Sorry, I was trying to...
Whistleblowers.
Yeah, no, it is. The whistleblower. Yeah, it's difficult. I think whistleblowers don't always feel confident. That is true, and don't always feel protected, and that is an issue. And I think for journalists, like for myself, you know, that's why you do need to just be completely, you just need to absolutely protect people who help you, who help you confidentially. You need to do everything you can to protect that confidence and that relationship, even if the person's not making that easy always, or an institution comes for you and tries to come after you to find out how you know things. So that's sort of, as a journalist, I would have that as an obligation beyond my obligation even to my employer or to the law, or you know, if I could be arrested or whatever, that my obligation would be to kind of not give away secrets. And that's definitely with Stephen's research, on Stephen's case, it's definitely stuff that people have helped, and no one knows who's helped me other than me and that person, and no one will ever know, you know. And so yeah, I think it's obviously people to definitely talk about the value of whistleblowers and things, because it is incredibly important. Yeah.
Last word, whistleblowers as the moral conscience of the nation?
I think people should be brave enough and do it. The fact of the matter is, no, a lot of people don't do it because there are economics. You need to eat. You've got children, whatever. But I remember a few years ago, I was interviewing for the police. I've done quite a lot of things. And so I complained that one of the, I don't know if it's superintendent or whatever level, or sergeant, whatever, was trying to coerce me to say a certain person should go through. And I made it clear, no, I'm an independent member on the panel. And they had this book to write in the book any concerns you had at the end of the day. So we were trained in how to do the interviews the police way. And so I wrote, that this senior person is trying to influence things, not on. That's me putting my head above the parapet. Well, I haven't been called back since. Too bad, but you know what? I can live with myself, yeah? Live with myself. So what I have done with it just recently, this is years ago, I've sent it to Mark Rowley to, because he's doing his cleaning up, isn't it? So I've sent it to him to have a look at.
Thank you, well done.
Thank you, amazing question. It's the reason why my talk was about the image of Stephen Lawrence as a metaphor for racial inequality, because at the essence of the Stephen Lawrence case, as you've been exploring, is denial and injustice. And that is something that's replicated in every single public institution that we are connected with, be it the NHS or academia or the criminal justice system and beyond. So as much as I'm championing the work of Daniel, it also requires whistleblowers to also meet him halfway, to provide information that allows him to come do his job, that you then can attack those denials and injustices within our institutions as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm afraid we've run out of time. It's been such a great pleasure to have you all here as an audience and to listen and discuss with our panelists. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedules and your investigation to come here. We're really grateful to you for that. And thank you to our BSL interpreters who've been very carefully working online. The last thank you to all of us in the audience who joined us today and online. Please, we hope to see you again at our events. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.